Well, now do you see the point? That everybody, if we transfer this to the dimension of spirituality, where the highest ideal is to be unselfish, to let go of oneself, when you are trying to be unselfish, you're doing it for a selfish reason. You can't be unselfish by a decision of the will any more than you can decide not to think of a green elephant. There is a story about Confucius, who one day met Lao Tzu, who was a great Chinese philosopher. And Lao Tzu said, "Sir, what is your system?" And Confucius said, "It is charity and love of one's neighbor and elimination of self-interest." Lao Tzu said, "Stuff and nonsense. Your elimination of self is a positive manifestation of self. Look at the universe. The stars keep their order. The trees and plants grow upwards without exception. The waters flow. Be like this. All your nonsense about elimination of self is like beating a drum in search of a fugitive." I had a friend who was studying Zen in Japan, and he got pretty desperate to produce the answer of who he really is. And on his way to an interview with the master to give an answer to the problem, he noticed a very common sight in Japan, a big bullfrog sitting around in the garden. And he swooped this bullfrog up in his hand and dropped it in the sleeve of his kimono. And then he went into the master, and to give the answer of who he was, he suddenly produced the bullfrog. And the master said, "Mm-mm, too intellectual." In other words, this answer is too contrived. It's too much like Zen. You've been reading too many books. It's not the genuine thing. So in this way, what is called the Zen problem, or koan, is likened to a person who swallowed a ball of red-hot iron. He can't gulp it down and he can't spit it out. Or it's like a mosquito biting an iron bull. It's the nature of a mosquito to bite, and it's the nature of an iron bull to be unbiteable. And both go on doing their thing that is their nature. And so nothing can happen. And you realize, absolutely you're up against it. Absolutely no answer to this problem. No way out. Now what does that mean? If I can't do the right thing by doing, and if I can't do the right thing by not doing, what does it mean? It means, of course, that I, who essayed to do all this, am a hallucination. There is no independent self to be produced. There is no way at all of showing it, because it isn't there. So you recover from the illusion, and you suddenly wake up and think, "Oh, what a relief." And they call that satori. That's awakening, the first step in awakening. When this kind of experience happens, you discover that what you are is no longer this sort of isolated center of action and experience locked up in your skin. That by being, the teacher has asked you to produce that thing, to show it to him genuine and naked, and you couldn't find it. So it isn't there. And when you see clearly that it isn't there, you have a new sense of identity. And you realize that what you are is, as I said, the whole world of nature doing this. Now that's a difficult thing for many Western people, Because it suggests to them a kind of fatalism. It suggests that the individual is nothing more than the puppet of cosmic forces. So in the same way, when your own inner sense of identity changes from being the separate individual to being what the entire cosmos is doing at this place, you become not a puppet, but more truly and more expressively an individual than ever. This is the same paradox which the Christian knows in the form, "Whosoever would save his soul shall lose it."
The height of Buddhism, or the height of Zen, is to be perfectly ordinary. I've still missed the point, like the atheist has missed the point. But for this reason, then, there is an element in the art, the painting, the poetry, etc., which has been inspired by this kind of Buddhism. This kind of art where the subject matter is non-religious. Nevertheless, there is something about the way in which this non-religious subject matter is handled that stops you. And you know there's something strange about it. This is how I first became interested in Oriental philosophy and all that kind of thing. I had an absolute fascination for Chinese and Japanese painting, the secular painting, the landscapes, the treatment of flowers and grasses and bamboos. There was something about it that struck me as astonishing, even though the subject matter was extremely ordinary. And I just, as a child practically, I had to find out what was the strange element in those bamboos, in those grasses. I was being, of course, taught by those painters to see grass. But there was something in there that one could never pin down, never put your finger on. And that was this thing that I will call the religion of no religion. My mother taught physical education at a school in England, which was specially designed for the daughters of missionaries to China. When the missionaries went on their way to China, and most of them were Baptists, they left their daughters at the school, and often they gave presents of objects of Chinese art, embroidery, pottery, and so on, to the mistresses of the school. And my mother, therefore, inherited a rather large quantity of very beautiful Chinese objects. And so from my earliest infancy, I was surrounded by these things. Now, it so came about that when I was about 10 to 11 years old, I began to read thriller or mystery stories written by such people as Edgar Wallace and Sax Rohmer about sinister Chinese villains. You remember Dr. Fu Manchu? And there were all sorts of others like that. Very, very strange, exotic figures who kept knives in their sleeves, who had ivory boxes full of the strangest poisons, who could practice the most exquisitely horrible tortures, but at the same time who had a kind of urbanity, a kind of culture that was never crude, always perfect manners. And whereas other children at that time of life wanted, when they grew up, to become engineers driving trains, or test pilots, or sports car champions, or whatever it was, I wanted to become a Chinese villain. And so, just as every child at that time of life decorates their room with the things they're interested in, I did the same thing, and I acquired from my mother's collection and from antique shops and all sorts of places Chinese and Japanese bric-a-brac to decorate my room. And so in this way, I became fascinated with the forms and the feeling of Chinese and Japanese art. And I still can't quite explain what it is. My mother, when she looked at certain kinds of flowers that were very beautiful, she said, it makes you feel jazzy inside. It hits you right here. So in the same way, when I looked at landscapes done in painting or in lacquer or on ceramics from China or Japan, I got a funny feeling inside here. There was a certain quality, a certain atmosphere of unbelievable beauty. And I couldn't explain it then, and I can't explain it now. But it caught me.
Now, reality is not spiritual, because that is a conception. Reality is not material. That's a conception. Reality is... You all know what it is, but you can't say. It's like when St. Augustine was asked, what is time? He said, I know what it is, but when you ask me, I don't. Because you cannot translate this whole realm of nature into the linear system of words. Words compel you to think of the world one thing at a time. But the world does not exist in that way. It exists in the manner of everything, everywhere, all together at once. If I put it into scientific language, we would say that what is going on in nature, if thought about in words, or if counted in numbers, consists of so many variables that you can't handle it.
Do you remember the Great Depression, when one day everybody was doing business and things were going along pretty well, and the next day there were bread lines? It was like someone came to work and they said to him, sorry chum, but you can't build today. No building can go on, we don't have enough inches. He said, what do you mean we don't have enough inches? We got wood, haven't we? We got metal, we even got tape measures. He said, yeah, but you don't understand the business world. We just haven't got enough inches, just plain inches. We've used too much of them. And that's exactly what happened when we had the Depression. Because money is something of the same order of reality as inches, grams, meters, pounds, or lines of latitude and longitude. It is an abstraction. It is a method of bookkeeping to obviate the cumbersome procedures of barter. But our culture is entirely hung up on the notion that money has an independent reality of its own. And this is a very striking, concrete example of what I'm going to talk about, of the way we are bamboozled by our thoughts, which are symbols, and what we can do to become unbamboozled. Another example of this fantastic confusion is that not so long ago, the Congress voted a law imposing stern penalties upon anyone who should presume to burn the American flag. And they put this law through with a great deal of patriotic oratory and the quoting of poems and so on about Old Glory, ignoring the fact entirely that these same congressmen, by acts of commission or omission, are burning up that for which the flag stands. They are allowing the utter pollution of our waters, of our atmosphere, the devastation of our forests, and the increasing power of the bulldozer to bring about a ghastly fulfillment of the biblical prophecy that every valley shall be exalted, every mountain laid low, and the rough places plain. But you see, they don't notice the difference between the flag and the country. Or as Korzybski pointed out, the difference between the map and the territory.
Wherever you fly across the world in a plane, and the landscape suddenly begins to look rectangular, where there are straight lines and clear triangles or clear circles, you know human beings have been around. Where they haven't been around, the outlines of everything are wiggly, like the courses of rivers, the shapes of mountains and forests. Because human beings are always trying to straighten things out. But we ourselves are not straightened out. We are wiggles. And we're interminably wiggling. But we are trying to regulate our wiggling by setting ourselves up in houses and going along streets with traffic lights and regulations and so on. But we are wiggling. We're trying to straighten out this wiggling. But wiggling is basic. So the whole world, especially us, is a Rorschach blot. And science is the art of trying to make unanimous sense of this block. And what science does is, it isn't that there are certain fixed laws of nature which things obey. It isn't as if the wiggly events of the world are running on tram lines, and they have to do that. They don't have to. Point is that in order to make sense out of what is going on, there's no way of making sense, because sense and order are the same thing. Therefore, we invent orders and describe the way things fit them.
You are in relationships with the external world that on the whole are incredibly harmonious. Going back to this illustration of every living body as something like the flame of a candle, the energies of life in the form of temperature, light, air, and food, and so on, are streaming through you all at this moment in the most magnificently harmonious way. And you're all of you far more beautiful than any candle flame. Just sitting in these chairs, just going, you know? Only we're so used to it. We say about that, so what? Show me something interesting. Show me something new. Because it's a characteristic of consciousness that it ignores stimuli that are constant. When anything is constant, it says, okay, that's safe, it's in the bag, needn't pay attention to that anymore. And therefore, we eliminate systematically from our awareness all the gorgeous things that are going on all the time, and instead only become focused on the things, the troublesome things that might happen to upset it. Which is all right, but we make too much of it. And we make so much of it that we identify our very selves, I, ego, with the radar, with the troubleshooter. And that's only a tiny fragment of one's total being. So that if you do become aware that you are not simply that scanning mechanism, but you are your complete organism, then very swiftly, in turn, as a consequence of that, you become aware that your organism is not the way you think about it when you look at it from the standpoint of conscious attention, from the standpoint of the ego. From the standpoint of the ego, your organism is your kind of vehicle, your automobile in which you go around. But from a physical point of view, your organism is again like the candle flame or the whirlpool. It is something which is a continuous patterning or activity of the whole cosmos. The key idea here is pattern. Let's suppose I'm going to borrow a metaphor from Buckminster Fuller. Suppose we have a rope, and one section of this rope is made of Manila hemp. The next section is cotton. The next section is silk. The next section is nylon, and so on. Now we tie a knot in this rope, just an ordinary one-over knot. And you find by putting your finger in the knot, you can move it all the way down the rope. Now, as this knot travels, it's first of all made of Manila hemp, it's then made of cotton, it's then made of silk, it's then made of nylon, and so on. But the knot keeps going on. And that's the integrity of pattern, the continuing pattern, which is what you are. Because you might, you know, be for several years you might be a vegetarian, and you might be a meat eater, and so on, and you know your constitution changes all the time, but people, your friends still recognize you, because you're still putting on the same show. It's the same pattern. That is the recognizable individual. But we are trained in our language. The very structure of the language we talk deceives us into misunderstanding this. Because when we see a pattern, we ask, what's it made of? Like you see a table. Is it made of wood or is it made of aluminum? But then when you inquire into what is wood, and how does wood differ from aluminum? The only thing a scientist can tell you is the different patterns, that is to say, the different molecular structure of the two things. And a molecular structure is not a description of what something is made of, it is a description of what dance it is performing, what motions, what kind of a symphony this is. Because basically, all phenomena of life are musical, and gold differs from lead in exactly the same way that a waltz differs from a mazurka. It's a different dance. And there isn't anything that's dancing. That is a deception we get into because we have two parts of speech in our grammar. We have nouns and verbs. And verbs are supposed to describe the activities of nouns. And this is simply a convention of speech. You could have a language with only verbs in it. You don't need any nouns, or you could also have a language with the nouns only and no verbs. And it would perfectly adequately describe what's going on in the world. So if you were used to speaking with a language that had one part of speech, you could say just as much as we can with two, and be a lot clearer. Only at first it would sound awkward, but you'd soon get used to it. And then when you got used to it, it would be a matter of common sense that the patterning of the world is not some kind of stuff that's patterning. You don't have to seek for a substance underlying the whole thing, it's just patterning. And we're all that. And so in this way, there is, to a person who really wakes up, you very soon realize that your existence is not something that is just the hopeless little creature that's suddenly confronted with a great big external world that goes gah at him, you know, and eats him up. Every tiniest little thing that comes into being, every minute little fruit fly or gnat or bacterium, I will go so far as to say, is an event upon which this whole cosmos depends. This thing goes both ways. It's not only that every little organism which exists depends on its total environment.
The reverse is also true, that the total environment depends on each and every one of those little organisms. So that you could say, this universe consists of an arrangement of pattern in which every event is essential to the whole thing. Now, we screen that idea out of our consciousness in exactly the same way that we screen out the perception of space as an important reality. Just as we pay attention to the figure and ignore the background, so we see one way of looking at things, namely that the organism is very frail against the environment. It lasts a long time, the environment, but the organism only lasts a short time. What do you mean the environment lasts a long time? What does the environment consist of? Just a lot of little things. And yet there is the environment, just as the same way as there is the face in the newspaper photograph behind all those little dots. When you get far enough away from it, you see the face. When you get far enough away from all the organisms and the little bits of things, you see the environment in another scale of magnification. But actually, the whole thing is arranged in a polar system where the enormous depends on the tiny and the tiny depends on the enormous. And you get a relationship between these extremes, which can be called a transaction. That is to say, a transaction, when there's buying and selling, it's impossible to have buying without selling and selling without buying. So you always, wherever you are looking at the general panorama of sensory experience, try switching. Try shifting your attention to all the things you thought were unimportant. To the constants, to the background. Now, of course, everything is fundamentally in harmony with the Tao. In the book called the Zhengyong, or the Unwobbling Pivot, it is said, the Tao is that from which nothing can depart. That from which things can depart is not the Tao. Fundamentally, you see, you can't get away from it. It's a situation in which we are all floating in a tremendous river. And the river carries you along. Now, some of the people in the river are swimming against it, but they're still being carried along. Others have learned that the art of the thing is to swim with it. And they're carried along too. But they know it. I remember once, I was looking in the open air, and one of those glorious little thistledown things came, and I picked it up like that and brought it down, and it looked as if it was struggling to get away, just as if you caught an insect by one leg, like a daddy long legs or something of that kind. It seemed to be struggling to get away, and I thought, well, it's not doing that. That's just the wind blowing. Then I thought again, really? Only the wind blowing? Surely it is the structure of this thing which, in cooperation with the existence of wind, enables it to move like an animal, but using the wind's effort, not its own. It is more intelligent being than an insect, in a way, because an insect uses effort, like a person who rows a boat uses effort. But the man who puts up a sail is using magic. He lets nature do it for him with the intelligence to use a sail. See? Now that is the most highly skillful art of all. That is Taoism in perfection, the art of sailing. Very intelligent.